Trust Business Lunch. Afternoon now. It's John Williams. It's 12:09. I started 9 in the morning, go to noon, then stick around noon to 1. Pete Zimmerman produces the show and always lines up good guests on Monday. Elise Glink usually starts us out, and today is no exception. Elise, let's talk a little bit about real estate. I just maybe wanted to start with something that's not the most important thing in real estate, but it caught my eye. A 3D printed house. There is such a thing? You can get one?
You can if you've got $299,999.
Oh, my God, I do. So what, what do
you
I do?
You have to move to New Jersey, John. Well, so this is interesting because we've been talking about 3D homes and 3D printed homes for a long time and how this has the potential to really cut down on costs, speed up production, and provide housing in places around the world where access to housing is really difficult. And you see 3D homes have already sprung up, small homes, like tiny homes, even smaller than tiny homes, in places in Mexico, in other warm weather countries. But to my knowledge, this is just about the first 3D printed house for sale, and it's in New York, not New Jersey.
1,400 square feet, it's got a garage. So I guess a machine, layer upon layer upon layer, lays down some sort of material that becomes the exterior and interior walls of a home, and then they must assemble it piece by piece, something like that, huh?
That's right. So this autonomous robotic construction system that the company has created will basically pour concrete layer by concrete layer. And when you look at the vision of it, and I'm sure that your producer, Pete Zimmerman, can put up a link to the story so people can see what this looks like. From far away, it actually looks like siding. Gray siding, which is on the house. And so layer by layer, they build this external foundation, concrete. One nice thing about concrete, by the way, it's got a very high R factor, meaning that for cold weather, it's really good at insulating. And it's a lot less than a stick-built house, right, where people are actually out there and they're, you know, cutting up the wood and they're putting it all together. I mean, it's a lot less expensive.
Let's leave that and go on to the labor market. I noticed you said it improved in January, but not by much, maybe by so little that it was a disappointment, right?
Well, I think it's a bit of a disappointment. So we saw on Friday, or maybe it was Thursday, no, I think it was Friday, the economy added about 49,000 jobs in January, and the unemployment rate fell a little bit, but that was mostly because people kind of have been unemployed for so long, they're starting to drop out of the workforce altogether, which is a really bad sign. And if you look at the prior 2 months, so December and November, job totals were revised downward by almost 160,000. So overall, it was kind of a pathetic reading on the economy.
What are you hearing about Janet Yellen's read on the economy? She thinks next year we'll be back to full employment.
I know. Wouldn't that be exciting? And it has a lot to do with the almost $2 trillion that the Biden administration wants to pump into the economy. This is going to provide if it goes through as planned, would provide a tremendous push for getting people into really good paying jobs, right? It would help boost the infrastructure program that's been talked about for a number of years. It would also provide a huge amount of money towards getting people immunized and getting PPE out and trying to get people to feel comfortable with returning back to work.
I want to ask you about the service sector. What's happening in those jobs? I want to ask you a little bit about the stimulus package and what you're seeing and what's happening with mortgage rates. Elise Glink's our guest. Visit thinkglink.com. Still to come, what's going on with the old post office downtown Chicago? We'll catch you up on that news on the Wintrust Business Lunch. It's 12:16 on WGN Radio. Elise Glink is our guest. Visit thinkglink.com. She's the real estate and financial wellness expert. Before we move on to those two other topics that I highlighted, anything else you want to say about the real estate market generally? It is the day after the Super Bowl.
Well, it's officially open for business, although I think that things are zooming along quite nicely. There was a report out of New York that in New York City, sales of very high-end homes, anything over $10 million, I know it sounds like an incredible number, but there were 30 sales at $10 million plus last week. And what's notable about this is that the market has been burning hot for almost every type of property except big cities, New York City, expensive homes, and San Francisco. But it looks like prices have come down enough and interest in buying these very, very high-end homes in New York City and some other places is increasing. And that's actually a good sign for overall in the economy. Also, mortgage interest rates rose slightly last week, but they are still at almost record historic lows. And that's just pushing everybody to get out there and do something fast.
Do you know, are people doing 30-year fixed, or since you can even get below 3, you're talking 2s, as I understand it, if you do a 10 or 15, are people buying down their mortgage rate that way, the way we used to when the numbers were a lot higher?
I think people are doing a bunch of different things. We saw a 10-1 adjustable rate ARM, meaning that the loan is actually fixed for 10 years and then it converts into a one-year adjustable. That rate, it was just slightly over 2%, which is really an incredible, incredible rate. But 30-year rates are only slightly higher, 2.6 to 2.75%, 2.75%. You still can get 30-year rates under 3%, which is, again, absolutely incredible. So I think what we're seeing is it depends on the kind of property you're buying and what you can actually afford to qualify for, because that's obviously a big thing. For some people, they're not going to be able to qualify for a 10-year loan, but they may well qualify for a 10-1 adjustable rate mortgage. So my best advice to people is shop around, because different big-name lenders don't have the same kind of loan offering. So if you go to Bank of America or Chase, it may be very different from what they offer you at Loan Depot or Rocket Mortgage. That's why it's best to really look at 4, 5, or 6 different types of lenders, mortgage brokers, other people, just to get the very best deal.
Boy, 10-1 for 2.6. If you need it, if you qualify for it, it's really hard to turn down 10 years, even though it's an ARM, at 2.6. When it adjusts, I was talking to David Hochberg about this, and I don't know if I have it exactly right. There's a cap on how much it can adjust upwards. So you wouldn't go in the 11th year from 2.6 to 7, right? It can only go up 1 or 2 points, right?
That is correct. 1 or 2 points. And just to be clear, the 10-year adjustable rate loan that I saw was actually just under 2.2%, not 2.6. The 2.6 was a 30-year.
Wow. Okay, but mortgage rates are up slightly, so maybe that's motivating some of these buyers right now. Not that they evidently weren't motivated anyway, but if they're going to go up, this is a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity, huh?
It is. I mean, they're not going up very far or very fast, and that's because the Federal Reserve has said they're not raising interest rates anytime soon. And in fact, we're starting to see noise about negative interest rates in this country. So what do I mean by that? I mean, if you put, you know, $1,000 into a savings account, instead of getting, you know, let's say 1% on your money or 0.5%, you might actually only get 990 dollars back. You might actually lose money by putting money in savings. That's what negative interest rates do. But in terms of buying your house, so it's bad for people who are depending on fixed income. But if you're buying a house, it means that mortgage interest rates probably aren't going up anytime soon.
Yeah, if they're lending the money at such a low rate, they're not going to be making much money with your savings. So they'll hold on to it and promise that you're not going to lose a lot. But weirdly, they'll promise that you'll lose a little. That's really weird math. Talk about the service sector, Elise. What's going on there?
So we saw that the ISM Services Index improved in December. It went up a point to about 58, little almost 59. That indicates expansion, not strong expansion, but a little bit of expansion. The problem, if you look deeper into the numbers, is that other sectors aren't doing as well. So you would think that trucking would be going up, but it's not. Actually, if you look a little bit more deeply, the trucking industry is actually compressing. So service sector is looking a little bit better. Obviously, hospitality is coming up from the lows, but it's extremely slow. Restaurants, we're still not seeing, just starting to see openings. Iowa did announce that they were going to remove all restrictions. So I guess if you want to go eat a meal in a restaurant with a lot of other people, just cross the state and you'll be able to go do that over in Iowa. But in terms of the whole country, I think the most encouraging thing, John, is that over 30 million people, about a tenth, just under a tenth of all Americans, have now been inoculated, at least with the first shot for COVID. And really getting our economy back on track means getting everybody their inoculation and starting to just move forward.
Iowa's going to 100% capacity on their restaurants, indoor dining?
That's what I read.
Wow. What are you seeing about the stimulus package? What's the latest, sticking point on the negotiation there? How close are they?
Well, I think it's really interesting. The Democrats have decided they're going ahead full speed. And one of the things that...
happens sometimes. Isn't that funny? Yeah, yeah. Right about now, once in a while, the phone line quits. It's 12:23 on WGN, and I want to know what she has to say about where the stimulus package is. It's $1.9 trillion. The Democrats are going full steam ahead. I guess they don't have to have the Republicans going along, but it doesn't mean that you should take everything you can get. I mentioned this earlier on the show today, and we'll get Elise back here in a second. What should the cap be? What should the amount be? Who should get it? And maybe if we have time, how much should we forgive of student loans? Elise is back. You said Democrats are full speed ahead, right, Elise?
I did. And they are about to unveil legislation to provide $3,000 per child to tens of millions of American families. What they're trying to do is give every child, every parent, $3,600 over the course of the year per child under the age of six, and it would come as a payment from the Internal Revenue Service. And Mitt Romney, a Republican, is on board. He wants to give even more. And so this is supposed to be a big part of what the stimulus package is going to be doing.
Do you know what the limits are income-wise to participate in these packages, these programs?
Sure. Right now, the size of the benefit would diminish for Americans earning more than $75,000 a year and for couples earning more than $150,000 a year. So it would fall off at that point in time, and the payments would be sent starting in July. And then in addition to this, because this would all fall on the backs of the IRS, which has had its budget cut severely over the last 4 years, the stimulus package would include a big push to beefing up the IRS to make sure that they're prepared for this kind of initiative.
And there's no plan to figure out who's actually losing money or not. That is, say a working couple's making $140,000 a year. They would then qualify for a stimulus package, even though they are still making $140,000 a year. That's about what they would and should be making. And yet we're going to, by this package, give them more money than they would have earned regardless.
This would be, let's say they have two children, and the two children are under the age of six. And so what they're proposing is that they would get $3,600 per child as a child benefit. And so the question really is, why do we want to do this? And one thing that's popped up is that the United States is way behind supporting families with children. If you look at other developed countries, we really don't do nearly what they do. And so one of the things about this is to allow families who have young children to encourage them to help them get over the cost. Now, you've got kids and I've got kids, and we both know that we spend well over $3,600 per kid on food and on clothing and on daycare and all the rest. And this is just supposed to help defray the cost. And the reason we want to do this is that the birth rate is falling dramatically in this country, and we don't want to get into a situation where we literally are going to be losing population because the birth rate isn't even keeping up with the death rate. And so that's, statisticians have looked at this and are hoping that if we financially help support families and we help them, you know, with the cost, the extraordinary cost of raising children, they'll want to keep having children, which would be very good for this country.
Well, that's a lot longer view than I thought we would be taking, at least right now. It seems to me like mostly we just need to get kids in school, moms and dads back into work. Forget about the population for a moment. But I suppose that would help if you have a five-year-old. You may have to stay at home and help that kid out if they're doing remote learning. That may compromise your ability to make money. So a $3,600 payment per child makes sense in that case, doesn't it?
It does. And just to get back to the stimulus, this is all, you know, part of this stimulus package, you know, getting kids back in school, getting teachers to teach, you know, getting the world back to what it used to be, what it could be. You asked the question about, you know, why Janet Yellen thinks we're going to get there with the stimulus package. And the answer is because all of the money that's in there goes in some way, shape, or form to helping get the world as we used to know it back to where it was. And whether that's with PPE or inoculations and vaccines or supporting families who have had to step back, particularly women, from the workforce to help care for kids and put them through school, all of that is part of getting this country back running again.
I know a big question for a lot of you is, okay, how much of that stimulus money goes into the economy? How much of it goes into savings? I'm out of time today. We'll finish that conversation next week. Talk more about that later this week, too. Nice to talk to you today, Elise. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you, John.
ThinkLink.com is her website, the real estate and financial wellness expert. That's Elise Link. This is the Wintrust Business Lunch. Catherine Davis is our Monday afternoon guest, associate editor, ChicagoInno.com. We follow the tech scene in the city with her. Thanks for joining us, Catherine.
Hi, John. How are you?
Pretty good. Do you have a good Super Bowl Sunday?
Yeah, pretty good. It was fun to watch the halftime show. That's the highlight for me.
So you're not into the game. And some people weren't so happy with the weekend. What did you think of the performance?
I thought it was pretty good. You know, it was interesting that he was able to take full advantage of the entire field, because usually there's an audience out there, but no audience this year.
He started some songs and my daughter-in-law went, uh-oh, can't do this one. But then he'd give us the PG-13 version, the Super Bowl-friendly one. I wasn't sure if he was lip-syncing sometimes. The audio mix on those performances is never perfect. I think that was evidence that maybe he was doing some measure of live to tape. But who cares, right? It's such a production. I'm just happy to see it on TV, you know?
Yeah, absolutely.
Let's talk about the tech scene. We'll start with the old post office downtown, the old main post office. What's going on there?
Yeah. So, you know, as you can imagine, in the last year, fewer and fewer, you know, employees, almost no employees are going into offices. And we've actually been sort of seeing a commercial real estate trend where some of these bigger companies that have huge offices are now subleasing some of that space just because, you know, they either don't need it right now or they're sort of downsizing over the long term. And the latest company to do so is Uber, the ride-hailing company that almost everyone knows. They, you know, on Friday confirmed that they are putting up 86,000 square feet of their office up for sublease. And that's in addition to 65,000 square feet that was already on the market for sublease from them. So, you know, it's just sort of continuing a trend here. They said that, you know, fewer employees are going into the office because of the pandemic and they just don't need the space. And, you know, I'm sure they're also feeling the sort of the financial constraints of the pandemic. If fewer people are, you know, hailing Ubers and being able to save some money, I think is also part of the plan here.
I toured that building with the Chicago Architecture Tour, the series of, you know, tours they do in the fall where you get to look at various buildings that you might not otherwise. And the lobby and front area of it was spectacular. Lord, there's a lot of space in there. And there are, it looks beautiful. What a great place to have an office.
Yeah.
And there
no, absolutely. I've been there too. And the architecture and design is really great. Like you're saying, right in the lobby, I was there for an Accenture event last winter, right before the pandemic, actually. And I was really amazed by what they had done in there.
And there are companies that are, Pepsi's in there. Isn't Walgreens have some offices in there, too?
Yeah, Walgreens and CBOE.
Yeah. Let's talk about this other company that you might be able to shed some light on called Presidio. What should I know about Presidio?
Yeah, so Presidio is a new Chicago startup from some serial entrepreneurs. You know, the two founders previously had a real estate document management company, and that was acquired by DocuSign in 2013. And so now they're on to their second venture called Presidio. And, you know, basically what they've created is a secure online vault to store important documents. So think things like your will, your trust, any legal agreements, health records, property and financial records. The idea is that you upload them to this online vault. And they're completely safe there. You can also, you know, give other people like family members or advisors access to those documents. You know, and the idea is to really kind of consolidate all these important documents for someone. You know, I think one of the examples they used was, you know, if someone dies, using, you know, this platform to access all their important documents just makes it easier, right? You're not searching through drawers and different mm-hmm. files, right? Mm-hmm. Looking for all the necessary documents to take care of someone's estate. So this is really, you know, designed to simplify that process and just sort of keep everything in order.
Talk to me about Tovala, T-O-V-A-L-A.
Yeah, so Tovala was in the news last week because they raised $30 million in venture capital funding. I think this is like their third funding round. They've raised more than $70 million to date. And right here in Chicago, they've created a smart oven that uses a combination of steam and broiling to, you know, create really easy and quick meals for people. So the idea is that, you know, you buy this oven and then you also subscribe to their meal delivery service and they'll deliver you ingredients and prepared meals that all you have to do is pop them into the oven and, you know, type in a barcode. The oven will know exactly what you've put in there and cook it, you know, to the exact temperatures and, you know, whether it's steaming or baking or broiling, and you'll have a meal quicker than you would trying to make it yourself.
Mm-hmm. So you pay a couple hundred bucks for the oven, but and then subscribe to the meal service. But my understanding is that then the cost per meal goes down. So you've got that upfront cost, but then the delivery of the food is under 15 bucks, right?
Yeah, they say that it's about a $12 per meal. So, you know, if you're someone that's ordering from Grubhub or DoorDash, this using Tovala is probably going to be significantly cheaper.
I also wonder what the lifespan is of this. Because this sounds like a good idea, still in the midst of a pandemic. I wonder if in August people are still going to want these kinds of services, you know?
Yeah, no, definitely a great point. You know, I think with Tovala, they've seen a lot of, you know, business amid the pandemic. People are, you know, forced to eat most of their meals at home these days, and they're trying to figure out easier ways to do that. But, you know, I think Tovala wants to capitalize on this growth during the pandemic and really go mainstream. You know, it wants to be known with other kitchen products like the Nutribullet or the Instant Pot, right? And I think, you know, they're now airing commercials on television and, you know, they have more marketing efforts. And the idea is, you know, capitalizing on the COVID growth to become a sustainable company even once it's over.
Jim Dahlke, your colleague, did a story about Ralph Lauren. Why is Ralph Lauren in the news in Illinois?
Yeah, so Ralph Lauren, am I pronouncing it right? I think it's Ralph Lauren. But they backed a material startup here in Illinois. The company is called Natural Fiber Welding. And they were in the news last week because they are opening a new facility in Peoria. And what they're doing there is they're making plant-based leather. So, you know, the simplest way to describe this is just a new kind of fake leather or alternative leather. You know, right now, a lot of the fake leather that we buy, you know, for in bags and clothing and stuff is made out of plastic and glues. But Natural Fiber Welding is creating alternative leather out of things like waste cork, hemp, coconut, and vegetable oil, and just more sustainable materials and ingredients than, you know, what is normally being used.
And then do they sell that to manufacturers who will turn it into items, or are they actually producing those items then as well?
No, so they are selling this to, you know, clothing designers and retailers who will turn this into actual products that consumers will buy. They're very much a B2B company.
I see. And is that sort of a politically correct direction for Ralph Lauren to go? That is, it's not animals that are being used in the production of this product?
Yeah, I mean, you know, you would imagine that a company like Ralph Lauren, you know, they want to stay ahead of the curve, right? They're competing with more retailers than they probably ever have in their life cycle. And so, you know, kind of staying ahead of trends and staying plugged into, you know, new ways of producing clothes and accessories and stuff will, you know, really benefit them in the long term as they, you know, stay relevant and competitive in a crowded, you know, clothing market.
That's Catherine Davis, Associate Editor, Chicago Winnow. We'll talk next week. Thanks, Catherine.
Thanks, John.
This is the Wintrust Business Lunch. This is WGN Radio, and the news keeps rolling now. Here's Steve Grzanich.
Start your timer. It's time for the Wintrust Business Minute, sharing Chicago's business news of the day. Uber has thrown its expansion at Old Post Office into reverse. The company's seeking to sublease 150,000 square feet at the site, which is more than double the amount of a sublease plan announced before the pandemic. The decision comes as downtown Chicago office space vacancy hits a record high. Many Uber employees are working remotely, a trend that's likely to continue in the months ahead. Four new food pantries are opening in Chicago and the suburbs, thanks to a major grant from the Greater Chicago Food Depository. Four grants in excess of $200,000 will help open new food pantries in the Roseland, Englewood, and Little Village neighborhoods in Chicago, and a fourth site in South Suburban Dalton. Crane says the food depository has shifted its funding strategy to focus on neighborhoods of color that are disproportionately impacted by hunger and poverty. I'm Steve Grzanich, and that's your Wintrust Business Minute.
Amy Guth joins us on the Wintrust Business Lunch. Hi, Amy.
Hi, John. How's it going today?
It's going good. Let's talk about what's going on with Target. Steve Alexander touched on this earlier this morning. What's the news there?
Yeah, so Target has their activewear brand has hit $1 billion in sales. They've gained a lot of ground in apparel. If you remember kind of at Target's evolution, apparel was not part of their original thing. It was a really small piece, and it's steadily grown. But in particular, they're all in motion. That's their you know, athletic wear brand. Has really, you know, grown so much. It was kind of a case of perfect timing when a lot of people were not going to the office. They were wearing yoga pants and athletic stuff at home, things like that. But they feel like this is going to continue, and this has given them the opportunity to kind of build out some of their other brands. Cat and Jack, Good and Gather, which is their food and beverage line. Up and Up is a personal care and household essentials brand. So this is kind of a moment that gave a little extra runway for Target.
In a way, I'm not surprised. I think that they've always had good prices. They've always had cute clothes and housewares. I think they lost their way a little bit. They were having trouble with stocking and inventory even before the pandemic, and especially so afterwards. But its core business is good. I've always thought that was a good company, right?
Yeah, and shares of Target are up 63% over the past year as of Friday. So, you know, Target is on track to do really well. You know, I think watching all of retail over this past year has been really interesting to see what sectors performed, you know, to see how different sectors performed. And those big box kind of stores like the Walmarts and the Targets that really would allow customers to make one fewer stop in order to get more stuff in one place. We really saw a lot of a boom from those.
And it's good price, too. I mean, that's been a trademark of Target. You know, I used to live and work in Minneapolis, which, of course, is Target's corporate headquarters. My neighbor was a designer for Cat and Jack, for that matter. And the prices were always good, too.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that's kind of part of the appeal of that big box store, that people can go in and kind of, it's the answer to the department store, plus tools, right? Plus groceries, all this other stuff. So it gives the shopper an opportunity to meet a lot of their shopping needs for a little bit lower. So we'll continue to watch Target, but I think that's a really interesting milestone considering this All in Motion brand was just, you know, a small blip on their radar not so long ago.
Elon Musk says he wants you to be able to buy a Tesla with Bitcoin. Is that right?
Yeah, this is such a big story today. A lot of people are talking about this on social media. So Tesla invested $1.5 billion in Bitcoin. They also said that they're going to start moving towards accepting Bitcoin as a form of payment. Now, they did note in their filing that that will be subject to whatever local laws, and initially that'll only be on a limited basis. But, you know, that sent prices to a record a little bit earlier. It was up as high as 16%. It's a little bit down now, but it got up to over 44,000. So it's been interesting because here's a moment where a lot of there was a lot of skepticism around Bitcoin for a long time and a lot of hesitation, even I think from some industry observers and leaders in that space that felt like, you know, it's not nothing. I'm not skeptical of it, but I don't know that I want to put a vast fortune into it yet. Here comes Tesla with this $1.5 billion investment, which is pretty significant. Now, they did that after they updated their investment policy last month to allow it to buy digital assets. So we kind of knew something was kind of coming, but they were kind of quiet about that. Of course, this fits in kind of the MO from Elon Musk,
exactly.
Sort of has this, you know, personality for doing this kind of stuff. But it'll be interesting to watch Bitcoin over the next couple of days to see if this is just kind of a one-time boost, if it keeps it up high, what that happens, and then how that begins to roll out for Tesla as they have said they would do, as they start to take Bitcoin as payment.
Or when does Chevrolet do it? That'd be a tipping point, wouldn't it?
Well, that too, right. When can you go buy like a Ford with Bitcoin, things like that? I think I'm sure a lot of automakers are watching very carefully to see what's happening. And here, you know, Rivian is the big name in Illinois because we have the plant in downstate Normal. And they've really been pretty clear about wanting to compete with Tesla. So I think it'll be interesting to see what their moves are after this. You know, Tesla has a lot of leeway to move and make moves like this. You know, we've just talked so much about Tesla this year and some of the moves they've made and how they performed on the market, things like that. But it will be interesting to see how other electric vehicles manufacturers respond to this, but then also those legacy business model or legacy businesses like the Fords and the Chevys and things like that, to see where they fall on this topic of, you know, what that means for taking Bitcoin.
World gets more and more complicated every day. Now we got to understand Bitcoin too. Amy Guth will probably follow this for us as well. Thanks, Amy.
Thanks so much, John.
Amy Guth on the Wintrust Business Lunch.